Yo, Nicole.
What's up?
If someone offered you a job to stay at a hotel in Colorado for the winter month, and you know there's a chance of a snowstorm or two or three, would you take this job as a groundskeeper?
And I'd be completely alone.
You can possibly bring your wife and child if you should have them.
And did any murders happen there?
Okay, yeah. So you're aware of murders having happened there like some decades ago. And you may or may not believe that it was built on an Indian burial ground.
I want to say no, but if I say yes, I know that a movie will be made out of my life.
I mean, obviously.
Obviously.
Eddie, would you?
Well, we survived 5 months in a two-bedroom apartment during the quarantine. So.
So we're more than halfway there.
Yeah.
We're making just fine. I told Eddie this before. If we ever bought a house, a beautiful house, and it's haunted, I'm making the ghost pay rent because I'm not moving out for them. You know,
It's okay if and if they refuse to pay, just put them in a box.
Yes,
It's
apparently
that
that's a thing that
easy.
you could do.
Apparently.
We'll find out about this. But guys, today we are talking about the one and only The Shining, based off of the Stephen King novel, and its sequel that came out late last year, 2019, Dr. Sleep,
Dr. Sleep.
directed by Mike Flanagan. And a lot of you guys actually had requested this when we had done a survey some while back, asking for people what they want to watch. And actually, I just got a text from a listener earlier this week saying, or last week, saying it's just like, you should cover Dr. Sleep. I want to get your opinions on it because Dr. Sleep apparently just dropped on HBO recently. So now's the time to strike.
Now is the time to strike. And also, wow, I didn't know listeners could text us. That's awesome.
Listeners do text me occasionally. The ones who know
that's
me
great.
Personally. No.
The ones that reach out, which is why you should reach out, guys.
But we got those Instagram messages as well, asking
Yes.
for different properties and stuff. And we're just like, maybe.
Maybe. And here we are catching up with stuff that now we have the time to go back and revisit. So
indeed, we do.
Without further, I'm Nicole.
And I'm Rolando.
And this is Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals.
An original podcast.
About unoriginality. So, obviously, like you said, it's quarantine. We're still kind of in the midst of it. New Jersey's doing pretty well compared to the rest of the country. But, you know, we're still kind of treating ourselves as if we're in self-isolation. What better way to celebrate self-isolation than revisiting Stanley Kubrick's The Shining and the sequel made 39 years later, Dr. Sleep.
Dr. Sleep.
This
so,
was...
every time I hear the word Dr. Sleep, though, I think of, you remember Mr. F in Arrested Development?
Mr. F.
I think of that as like the theme song for Dr. Sleep.
Dr. Sleep.
I don't know why. It's you also probably because I do all the time confuse Matthew, no.
Ewan McGregor.
Ewan McGregor with Michael Bluth all the time. They look literally the same.
I don't see it.
You don't see it? You
Not
don't see
at
Michael
all.
Bluth in Ewan McGregor and vice versa?
No.
I
don't see it.
I actually literally was watching the movie expecting it to be Michael Bluth because I forgot it was Ewan McGregor. Because he's in another Stephen King adaptation adaptation on HBO.
Who, Ewan McGregor or
no,
Michael Bluth? Jason Bateman.
Jason Bateman,
name.
Thank you. That's his name. Jason
which,
Bateman.
Which one is that?
Oh, what is it? It's like the one where he is suspected of a murder, but he has a solid alibi, including like camera footage. And there may or may not be something paranormal going about it. Hang on, let me see. The Outsider.
That was Stephen King?
That's also Stephen King, yeah.
Really?
Huh. Yeah.
There's just everything Stephen King at the end of the day.
Yeah, Stephen King is going through a resurgence. Or is it?
Yeah, is it?
We'll talk about that.
This is about the third or is it the fourth source material? The time we're discussing something that is a Stephen King property.
This is the second time, third time we've done a Stephen
third
King,
Third time,
right?
Okay.
We did it.
And Pet Sematary.
And Pet Sematary.
Cemetery.
And I don't think
yes.
we've done anything else. We've talked about it in the news because there have been other properties in the works. But
yes, and Castle Rock as a whole, which is something that we may or may not cover. And we kind of can't cover it, but it is a really interesting concept because they do Misery in the second season, which is technically
yes.
a remake of it. But what were you going to say?
No, I was thinking, I forgot that they're working on a Shawshank Redemption kind of prequel based off of Nurse Ratched. Not Shawshank Redemption. I'm sorry. One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest.
I was going to say Nurse Ratched.
Nurse Ratched is One Flew Over a Cuckoo's Nest. That's not Stephen King. That's
No, the Shawshank Redemption is Stephen King. Shawshank is Stephen King. The Cuckoo's Nest is not Stephen King.
No. Okay. There we go.
Yeah.
My okay. bad. Jack Nicholson. All these movies start melding into a certain point, you know?
I guess. Yeah. Okay.
I was thinking Jack Nicholson. That's why. So let's go okay. on. Let's talk about it.
So obviously talking about The Shining and Dr. Sleep. And normally we would say we shouldn't spend too much time on the source material because what we're trying to focus on are the two movies. But I do think that we need to shed some light onto the novel as in comparison, at least, to the movie. Now, have any of us read The Shining? Yeah. Have you read The Shining? I have not.
I've read half of The Shining because mm-hmm. of friends. I wanted to read it, but I'm not a big Stephen King reader, so I kind of just gave up.
Yeah. Okay. What about you, Eddie?
No.
You did not read it? Okay. So can you tell us a little bit about the book, Rolando, from what you read?
I was like in not even high school. I think I must have been like eighth or ninth grade. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Shining follows the story of a writer mm-hmm. who ends up going into a
Jack Torrance.
I think that was his name in the novel also. But yeah, he's going to maybe I didn't read that much of it if I remember. In retrospect, Jack is hired to be the watchman of the hotel, the Overlook Hotel in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And he brings along his wife and kid. He is a writer. I don't remember if he's a failed school teacher. Well, he's not a failed, he hated teaching. I don't remember that part is from the movie or the book, but I do know that he was trying to be a writer. That might be it. That's all I probably remember really off of it. Cause everything else now I just remember mostly from the movie.
I think that the basis is pretty much the same from the novel to the film. And then towards the end and certain character traits and endings are what it deviates, but it is essentially about this family of Jack Torrance, Wendy Torrance, and their son, Danny Torrance. And The Shining refers to this power that the child, Danny Torrance, has, which is essentially telepathy and yet also kind of a little bit of seeing, like, you know, the paranormal. Like he's like a medium, a telepathic medium.
Come and play with us. Come and play with us, Danny. Forever and ever. Ever.
Telepathic medium, yes.
That's pretty much what he is, and he has The Shining, which is a term that is told to him when they reach the Overlook Hotel by Halloran, who also has The Shining.
Yes, he's the head chef of the hotel, and he's the only person of color in this entire movie.
Yes, and probably in the book, too. I don't know if that was something that was changed.
Oh, man, I don't remember if he was black in the book.
There was another person of color.
In the book or in the novel?
Oh, in the book. In the movie.
I'm sorry, in the movie.
No. Oh, in the movie.
Who was the other person of color?
The one he calls from the airport.
Oh, Eddie. Come on. they get like a two-minute cameo. Does not count them as a character.
We are talking about 1980
facts
here.
Facts of
facts. So the movie, and I'm assuming that the novel does take these things into, they have the same in common, that Jack Torrance is a recovering alcoholic of only 5 months. Yes, prompted by the fact that on a drunken night, he fractured his son's arm in what seems to be a drunk, like, moment of violence.
Apparently the kid had strewn around all his paperwork of the novel that he may or may not have been working on. He gets mad, and then I have trouble, like, with this because I don't know if it's necessarily physical abuse. It was a moment of physical abuse, but I don't think he's physically abusive. Does that make sense? I think it's like, it seems like a genuine description of what happened, in which he grabs him and he just grabbed him too hard and he dislocated his shoulder, I believe, is what happened.
Well,
right?
That's something that the film leaves actually beautifully open, because the character of Wendy, as portrayed by Shelley Duvall, is so passive and just so, like, loving, that the way she tells the story really does make it seem like it could have been a moment of domestic violence that she's just severely downplaying.
Even then, though, but Jack Torrance, when he's also recounting the story to the ghosts, it's very similar, and it's not like, it's not a moment where he has like this self-awareness either, right? To like, he's lying to, why would he lie to a ghost?
Well, okay, so I guess because they're kind of interchangeable, especially when it comes to Dr. Sleep the movie, I'm gonna just talk about the movie a little bit. The book was only Stephen King's third book after Carrie and then Salem's Lot, and then
this is really Carrie, his third book.
It's only his third book. Carrie was adapted into a film by Brian De Palma, was an immediate success, and then you have Stanley Kubrick, who had just made Barry Lyndon, which wasn't that big of a success as he was hoping it would be. And Stanley Kubrick had a bit of an ego. When he made 2001 A Space Odyssey, he wanted to completely redefine the science fiction genre, which he did. He really wanted to redefine how to make like costume films, which he kind of did in Barry Lyndon. So he's like, I'm going to make the best horror movie out there because people are doing it better than me and I want to do it better than them. That's literally the reason why he wanted to make this
movie. Interesting. Would you consider this movie a horror movie?
Yes, I would.
I don't know if I do.
It's not tropey in the sense where, you know, you don't get a lot of jump scares.
I think it's
and
a drama.
Stuff, but no, I think it's a horror film.
I think it's, as anything, maybe a psychological thriller. But I don't see, it's not a, I don't get like, all right, maybe the third act is where like the horror comes into play from like, because it becomes like a slasher movie, right? A chase that's happening. But for the most part, like the movie is not that horrific. Or it's not scary.
I disagree.
I think it's very atmospheric, but I don't think it's very
scary. It is, which is what Stanley Kubrick's great at. I guess, scaring and like, you know, watching a horror movie to be scared is also one, really subjective.
Okay.
But fair. Two, it also kind of like varies in all over the spectrum in terms of like horror movies. I mean, would you say that Halloween scared you? And is it a horror movie?
Halloween. I mean,
it's categorized as a psychological horror.
Yeah, it's like within the subgenre of horror, I would say it was definitely that. Right, but fine, I would classify it as such.
Yeah, I don't know, but go on.
Well, so he wanted to make the ultimate horror movie. And also, he was always, at this point, at least in his career, he was interested in introducing a new technique into making movies. And this was one of the first times, at least, that a Steadicam was used, in the sense where it was a person holding this huge contraption and moving with it while the people were moving. Before, if you wanted to move your camera, it had to be on this whole track. This was one of the first times that a person was holding this in a Steadicam contraption, and that's why you have so much movement in this film. I feel like the camera is always fucking moving.
Did you ever have to use that in school?
The Steadicam?
Yeah.
I think I kind of did. Yeah. I mean, now they're like sticks.
Well, yeah, the gimbal.
But back in the day, it was every huge thing.
I remember William Patterson, my undergraduate school, was the only, not the only school, but like it was one of the few schools that actually had like an actual setup to do, you know, handheld camera.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
And it was, what a nightmare to work.
Yeah, because also, you know, if you watch a lot of films that sometimes are doing handheld camera, you can feel that a person's holding in their hands and you can feel their steps. You know, it's a little shaky and stuff. Like, I'm thinking like the opening of Narc where it's like kind of going all over the place. So the Steadicam was revolutionary because it doesn't pick up your steps. It moves very seamlessly and smoothly. So this is one of the first films that did that. And then I think that that's just like kind of overused now. It's such a part of filmmaking.
I would agree.
But so that was 1980, one of the first things, and I definitely also think that this film is incredibly, like you said, atmospheric. That was the one thing that Kubrick does very, very well, is that he gives you a place and he gives you a situation. He just, you feel it. You feel like you're there with the music, with the way that he shoots it, with everything. So that's just a little bit about Kubrick himself in this movie. Now let's kind of talk about the story and the characters, particularly, I think, the two main actors of Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall. I think that their performances are incredibly good. Particularly, I think this movie belongs to Shelley Duvall. I think that without her being as sweet and as passive as she is, Jack Torrance doesn't seem like the fucking like insane lunatic that he is.
I think they're great foils. I would agree with you.
Yeah, the yin and yang to
for
so
sure.
Much.
I don't know. That's a very, very big statement, bold statement, some might say.
Okay, so let's also look at Jack and kind of like how Jack became like Jack Nicholson is because there's something kind of off about him.
Well, right from the get-go. Like, I think early on, me and Eddie, when we were rewatching this, we were just like, wow, he's so fucking creepy.
He is. He has that sinister thing about him. And I'll tell you something about this movie is that Stephen King obviously is not happy with the film because it differs greatly from his novel. They do not portray, especially of Jack Torrance. Jack Torrance in the novel is supposed to be a little bit more compassionate to his family and really torn by his addiction that seems to be that was at one point controlling him, and that the spirits that are haunting the hotel and that are taking possession of him are kind of like using against him. Mm-hmm. And there are redeeming moments that he has towards the end. He doesn't just completely lose it and then become this homicidal maniac, which is what they kind of do in the movie.
Uh-huh.
So that's
that far.
So that's one thing with The Shining, but with the other thing is that because of who Jack Nicholson is, Stephen King was like, don't hire him. You should get John Voight to play it because he'll be able to have that kind of like that balance to this character that the character needs.
And wait, Stanley Kubrick
didn't listen. He wanted John Voight.
John Voight?
Yes. Who Angelina Jolie's father. Uh-huh. He was in Midnight Cowboy and
Wasn't
Coming
he also
Home
in
and Deliverance.
Anaconda?
He was in Anaconda. Yes, he was in Anaconda. He was in Lara Croft Tomb Raider as her father.
That's right. Like, yes.
A movie we covered. I actually think that looking at that casting in my head and like seeing how that movie could have played out, I definitely see what Stephen King was trying to go for and who Jack Torrance was in the book. But Stanley Kubrick adapted the novel to film and he made it very much his own. And he was like, no, my Jack Torrance is literally a homicidal maniac and Jack Nicholson's going to play that to fucking perfection. And I think that not only is Shelley Duvall just like so perfectly the yin to that yang, but I do think it's been widely reported that she was abused on set in order to get those results. And that's unfortunately, I mean, I think her performance is beautiful. It is such shit that they had to abuse her and play mind games with her to get that performance. But
what should be done with him?
I don't know.
I don't think that's true. I think you have some very definite ideas about what should be done with Danny, and I'd like to know what they are.
I think maybe he should be taken to a doctor.
Those are fairly recent allegations, right? Like
they, yeah, I mean, I think that before people were like, oh, you know, he was like kind of like, don't talk to Shelley or like, don't be nice to Shelley because he wanted to get a reaction out of her. And people before was like, oh, well, that's because he's a good filmmaker and he was trying to do his good job. And now today that we're a little bit more woke, we're like, no, fuck the film. Fuck like your directing tactic. That's a horrible thing to do to another human being.
Well, I guess it's a horrible thing to do if she wasn't a willing participant, right? If she didn't want to do the method acting.
Well, like, that's an assumption. I don't know if she's a method actor or if she was signing up for the method acting.
What? But is this the only thing that she's known for?
No, Popeye. She was actually... she was in Popeye. Yeah, she played Olive in the Popeye film with Robin Williams. She was in Annie Hall. She was in Nashville. She was in a lot of movies in the 70s, particularly with Robert Altman. She kind of quit acting after this, and a lot of people think that her time on The Shining attributed to her kind of like getting depressed and maybe even like losing it a little bit.
Hmm.
Which is a really huge accusation, and I'm not going to say, you know, it's definitely like Stanley Kubrick's directing of her that led her to what happened afterwards, but it should be at least noted. Nevertheless, she's fucking brilliant in the movie. Honestly, she breaks my heart. It's sometimes incredibly sad to see him be such a prick to her, which is why it's also so good.
I mean, yeah, she's able to... I think those moments where, like, Jack Nicholson just snapping at her and stuff, and, like, the movie, she just looks like a deer caught in headlights.
Yeah. Like, who
just, like,
are you?
No idea how to react and stuff.
But, I mean, it's also, like, I think that this film, I can't speak about the novel, because according to Dr. Sleep, too, the novel portrays Jack Torrance as somebody completely different than the movie does. But according to the movie, he hated his family from the fucking get-go. Like, this is just about a man who resented his family and was always probably going to do this. The hotel just provided a beautiful scapegoat.
Don't all men resent their family, though, on some level?
Apparently. I think this movie is, in some ways, and it doesn't even know it is, a beautiful commentary on you know, kind of like men who get really, really sick and become fascinated with violence and whatnot.
So, out of curiosity, why do you think that he... What makes you feel that, like, Jack Torrance hates his family prior to the events of the hotel?
He never seemed like he was that he wasn't active within his family. They're in the car.
Wasn't that symptomatic of the time back then, though?
Not necessarily. I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that maybe it was more like it just was more common. But I do think that, you know, with him in the car talking to them is a great big scene to see that, because he doesn't make eye contact with them. It seems like he doesn't really want to be engaging in conversation with them. He's like, mm-hmm. And then he tells them about the Donner family who resorted to cannibalism. And she's like, don't tell them about it. And Danny's like, no, I saw it on TV. He's like, see, he saw it on TV. And it's just like everything about his tone and his mannerisms. I think that's a really, really great scene, because one, it leads to the fact that he's a little sick in the head. But two, like, you could just tell that he kind of has some contempt for his family.
Right. Okay.
That was something I saw in that scene.
Yeah, so, I just picked up maybe that he wasn't necessarily... I think I just picked up not necessarily a guy who just didn't never love his family. I don't get me wrong. Throughout the movie, I think I always wondered, like, what the hell does Shelley...
Seeing him?
Yeah. Wendy. What does Wendy see in him? Or what the hell brought them together, right? Because sometimes I watch movies and you just wonder, it's just like, what circumstances brought these two characters together?
Yeah, seriously. I see what he sees in her. Someone to walk all over. But, what?
Oh, okay. I was about to say, it's just like, because her fashion sense, man, was a hot mess. Let me fucking tell you, those outfits were fucking... I saw it. Yeah. If I was married to someone who dressed like that, I'd be like, I fucking hate you too. All that corduroy and all those weird layerings, I can't. I won't. I would have gone crazy too, actually, in retrospect.
I will say, Stanley Kubrick, though, even though they're not like, I would never wear those outfits, he chose really good outfits for her in terms of her standing out and
they're
like
memorable.
Adding to her like matronly, passive mama vibe.
But man, those outfits were so ugly. Like, her first outfit was like this weird, like, overall dress, like denim, I think, and like this, like, red button down shirt. It was like, so what an eyesore. It's she made a choice to dress like that.
Yeah. So Danny suffers from The Shining, and he has premonitions in the first 10 minutes of the films about the things that are going to transpire at the Overlook Hotel. And it takes form in his imaginary friend, Tony, who lives in his finger. He sees visions of it. So he knows instantly, and it's his imaginary friend's like, why don't you want to go there? I don't know. I just don't want to go. Like,
now,
really, really
correctly,
creepy stuff.
I could be mistaken, but I could have swore that in the novel, that's not how it projects. I'm pretty sure he just talks. It's not like he doesn't do
probably.
That visual cue.
Well, he said that he lives in his mouth and hides in his stomach.
He did, yeah. He says that on the bed to the doctor in the film, too.
What does that mean? He lives in the stomach?
He hides in his stomach.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which just sounds like it's a very present voice within this boy's head.
Oh, yeah, you would think it'd be more like in the head kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, it's also a 5-year-old boy.
Oh, that's fair. He is 5. Is that how old he was supposed to be?
Yes, he's 5.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so Jack starts losing his mind slowly. The hotel kind of comes to life for him. It takes form into a bartender who feeds him drinks to... you know, feed to this bad behavioral problems that he has.
His name is Lloyd.
Lloyd, the bartender. Yes. And the whole hotel comes to life, which also, you know, Stanley Kubrick leads you to believe that this hotel is alive and it has a soul.
I actually, and this is where I think setting comes to mind, because as looking back on the setting, hideous decor, right? So tacky, but so iconic.
Yeah, oh no, absolutely.
It's just such a look at, like, the ballroom scene, for example, when it's finally filled and it's just like, oh, this is so glamorous. I take everything I said back about how ugly this all looks. But because it looked cool. That red bathroom.
Yeah, no, again, the atmosphere just, like, absolutely stunning, which is why I think, well, I'll say that when we get to Dr. Sleep, but it was inevitably any film that were to take place in the Shining universe has to pay homage to Stanley Kubrick's film.
If I remember correctly, the hotel is a real place, right? Like, they use
it's based on a real hotel, yes.
And didn't they use the actual hotel, though, in the movie?
So I don't know if I think they used the Stanley Hotel in Colorado for some of it, but I think a lot of the interiors were created on a soundstage.
Okay, interesting. No, because I remember, and Eddie, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but they changed the name of the room number from the novel to the movie because they were afraid that, like, it wouldn't get booked after this movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Like there's a whole documentary about that room and Stanley Kubrick conspiracy theories. I have not seen it, but
there's a documentary about this movie
called Room 237. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. No, I didn't know about that.
Yeah. But it's also about like hidden messages that people think are in The Shining, the film.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. One of them being that Stanley Kubrick admits in The Shining that he is the director of the moon landing and we never went to the moon.
Okay. Yeah. People always love reading into things.
Yeah. It's interesting that that's in The Shining, though. But yeah, Jack slowly loses his mind and he gets coerced by the ghost and the spirit of the Overlook Hotel to kill his family. So
that's one of those interesting things, right? You think he was forced by the ghosts?
I think that if they're like pouring him drinks and being like, yes, your family, they fucking suck, man.
But he wasn't really drinking, right? Because there was no alcohol to be drank.
If you believe that that was all in his mind, if he appeared at the bar and was like doing it, then maybe it was the hotel who supplied it.
But they said that they took away all the alcohol.
Yeah, the people, uh-huh. But not the hotel itself. Well, then that leads us to the end hotel, of the movie, though. Yeah.
Because the hotel like takes away the alcohol is what they said. If I remember,
the hotel itself.
Purposes. The hotel, yeah, because for insurance purposes.
Yeah.
No, insurance. But that's still like the people in the hotel, not the spirits and the evilness that lurking in the hotel. That's what I'm saying.
Oh, you're saying so you believe that the spirits can like manifest alcohol and give it to you, make you drunk.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
I mean, you know, they seem to be capable of anything. Well, okay. So the big thing about this movie is its iconic ending. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen The Shining.
And if you haven't seen The Shining,
go see it.
Yeah.
Jack Torrance does not succeed in killing Wendy and Danny. They were able to get away, partially due to Danny Shining. But poor Halloran was killed during the time. Danny's buddy.
Oh, my God. He died so
horrifically. Yeah, so quickly. Just wasn't even given a chance. They spoofed that really beautifully on the Treehouse Horror episode of The Shining of The Simpsons.
Yeah. That's easily so one of my favorite Treehouse of Horror. They did such a good job adapting that one.
They did so good. It actually made the Shining make more sense to me as a kid. Because I was like, oh, that's what that was. Anyway.
It's so funny. I actually saw The Shining first.
You saw The Shining first?
I saw The Shining before I saw The Shining.
That's great that you remember that it's The Shining because they don't want to get sued.
Yeah, that was a funny joke, right? Like in retrospect, it's just like, oh, you that's mean The great. Shining? It's like, shh, you don't want to get sued, kid.
Yeah, such a good joke. But they escape and Jack succumbs to the cold. He freezes to death and to his own madness. Then the film ends with this beautiful track-in shot of a picture of a New Year's party in 1921. And lo and behold, all the way in this whole group of people celebrating in the ballroom of the Overlook Hotel right at the bottom is Jack Torrance. Mm-hmm. And a lot of theories have occurred as to why this movie ends on this picture and why the hell is Jack Torrance in this picture. I kind of adhere to the theory that he was always meant to come back and for his spirit to, you know, come back to where it once was. That maybe he was a person in 1921, died tragically there, got reincarnated, and the hotel was calling for his body to come back, right? Especially early in the film when he's telling Shelley Duvall, he's like, you know, I feel like I've been here before. Like every time I turned the corner, I already knew what was there. You know, it's definitely implanting that he was always meant to be here, or that he was here before.
Okay.
And because of this, the hotel itself has these abilities. In the movie, at least, it's confirming to me that that's why it is able to produce alcohol and feeding into his alcoholic behavior and to possess his soul like that.
Yeah, so it's interesting, right? Because I always took that ending to be more along the facts of, like, the hotel consumed another soul.
And that it gets added to that picture?
And it gets added to the picture. Similar to, like, when we saw that episode of The Twilight Zone, where the comedian, like, after his set, like, and he finally dies or whatever. You remember this one? That was the first episode of the new Twilight Zone remake.
Yes, I remember. How did it end again?
It ended, it ends with him
deleting himself.
Yes, right. That's right. Anything that he says in his stand-up, any joke, any truth that he tells during his stand-up set, that person, that truth gets erased or they disappear. And eventually he has to tell the truth of him whole self and he'll disappear. And then he goes into the painting, right? Like he gets absorbed by the comedy club. So that's similar to what happens here, where I think the hotel is consuming these poor lost souls.
And they all get added to the picture.
And they all get added to the picture. So I think that
For something as cool as the Overlook Hotel, you know, consuming souls, why is it just going to add it to a picture?
Because who knows what ghosts do, what they do? Ask the.
I mean, I guess.
Indian burial ground. Is that a problematic term, by the way? Indian burial ground. I mean, that's what they said in the movie.
Probably. Let's call it a native burial ground.
Indigenous burial ground.
Native American.
I thought Native American was also problematic now.
I mean, yeah, it's preferred that they are indigenous, but I also think that Native American is preferred over Indian.
Indigenous or Aborigines, I think, is also, I've heard.
Well, I think they can also, that can belong to people of many different types. Okay. You know,
all right,
so.
Fine. We'll go with Native American. But if we're offending anyone, by all means, let us know. We'll try
yes,
to like,
please
correct
us. Yes. But yeah, so I don't know. But that's the thing. I don't think that the novel of The Shining ends that way.
No, to my understanding, the novel ends, Jack destroys the hotel.
Yes, and like he's Jack actually able to like come in and out of his possession and like, you know, tell his family to run to safety. Halloran does not get killed by him, and Jack ends up sacrificing himself for the safety of his family, which is so different from the movie. Because that Jack would not give two fucking shits about his family.
I happen to like this ending, to be honest. I like it.
In the movie or in the novel?
The movie.
I mean, because dreary ending. I also think that leaving it up open for discussion and just kind of making you go like, what? You know?
Fair enough.
I think Stanley Kubrick also is a slightly fantastical filmmaker. So yeah. He always has high levels of fantasy in his stuff.
And it's so interesting that we've talked about Shelley Duvall's acting abilities and Jack Nicholson. But like, what about the kid who plays Danny? Because I think he was also quite good in this movie.
He was good. I feel like most of the time, though, he was just like directed to just like look forward.
Oh,
and to
that's
not
fair.
Be engaged.
But
you know?
Yeah, but like, isn't that the way like all scary children act?
I mean, I think he set up like the whole stereotype in movies of like the scary, disturbed kid. Because after that, they just were like everywhere, kind of like the one that was spoofed really well in Scary Movie 3.
Yeah.
Like, that's Danny Torrance. And yeah, I think that for me, like children meeting like the horror movie genre is just always a mixed bag for me. I'm not a fan of violence towards children. I think that's just like a line that shouldn't be crossed.
Despite the fact that you like Harry Potter, isn't there like so much violence committed to like these?
But okay, so
children.
I guess then I should be clear about my statement is that in depicting violence against children,
okay,
you know, kind of like how, like, you know, you can depict rape in a couple of different ways, and some of them is educational and for the story, and then some of it is kind of exploitative and downright wrong and kind of is questionable as to why it should be there. You know, that's how I feel about violence against children, particularly also in the horror movie genre, because usually it's for gore and for shock value.
Yes. I think it might be the remake, the first chapter, I think was like the one that comes to mind where it comes to like kind of set the new bar for like violence committed
yeah,
to children.
Yeah, it's this new trend actually in horror movies where we're seeing more and more violence to children, which is something that I personally just do not.
Well, nothing is sacred anymore. So
enjoy.
Children are fair game.
Yeah, I mean, I'll see anyone else get killed as long as they're above the age of 18. But I also, children in horror movie, I think them putting them as like disturbed characters or like kind of like the wise one in their own creepy way, you know, it always just like. It's a hit or miss for me, but I think that Danny, the actor who played Danny, was very successful as, you know, the little shining kid he was.
Terrible fashion and terrible hair.
Terrible fashion, yeah. It was the 70s. This movie was, when it came out, a massive success. It was only made with $19 million and it grossed in $46 million. People still watch this movie every October for Horror Movie Month. Around Halloween, and this stuff is embedded into our culture. I mean, Red Rum. Like, Red everyone Rum. Says that. Here's Johnny. Everybody says that.
Well,
which,
I mean, that is
that's a no to Johnny Carson, yeah. But that's also, it's so ironic, and it's actually pretty hilarious.
I think the use of it, because it's still, like, it still will be referenced, I think, in contemporary media, like, breaking the door and then like having your head stick out and saying here's Johnny. I feel we just recently did a movie or TV show where like they kind of riffed on that scene and it's just like, wow,
did they? And what was it?
I just saw something recently and that happened.
Yeah, I don't recall. And but I've also seen so many, you know, allusions to
iterations
that
of that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even like when he's like with the when she's with the baseball bat, he's like, Wendy, light of my life in that whole thing where he's like, I don't want to hurt you. I'm just going to bash your brains in. Like that whole thing. Like I feel like people always quote that too. And of course, everyone's favorite, all work and no play make Jack a dull boy. Yeah. There's actually a great cocktail bar in Jersey City called Dull Boy. And they have a typewriter there, which is a reference to The Shining. Cute. Yeah. It's a great cocktail bar. Expensive as hell, but really great. You should check it out if you're in the Jersey City area. So really quick before we kind of end up The Shining, do you like this movie? And what do you think the point of this movie is? I can't talk about the novel and Stephen King's purpose for the novel, but the movie has some theories to it. What did you take from it?
There's a wider point to the movie. So I genuinely do like this movie. I remember the first time I saw this, I was in high school for sure. I must have been like,
definitely
after I had tried to watch at tried to read the novel and gave up, as I do with most of my novels that I do try to read. But I remember watching it with some of my friends and stuff, and because we used to pick like movies to watch in the I remember Cujo was the one we saw before Shining.
Cujo
sucked so much. I had no
desire. I love Cujo.
I stopped watching it and let my one friend. None of us liked it, right? Because we were ready for like a real horror movie, right? And Cujo, I don't think delivers on those horrors. Once we found out it was a dog movie, we were just like, oh, we lost interest. So I can't ever say I gave that movie a fair chance. So if it ever gets remade, and I have to sit down and watch it, I'll give it a fair chance. But I have not. And then the next one we would see would be The Shining, and yeah, The Shining again. I think even back then, I never thought this movie was particularly scary. But I think the performance and the madness of it were so good that it's just like kind of a movie that I have seen like several times. And I hadn't seen this movie again, I guess, since college, right? And rewatching it, it's still a joy to watch, you know? It's still a fun treat, I think. And I understand why people enjoy watching this like in Halloween. I would not want to watch this in quarantine. I think it has a different feel now that we've been
seriously.
Quarantine, right? Because I don't know. Like, thank God our house wasn't built on an Indian burial ground, because Native American burial ground, I'm sorry.
Hey, you don't know that.
It could be, right? Any plot of land in America could be built on a Native American burial ground and not know it. So but yeah, rewatching it in kind of with that kind of new atmosphere that we're, it's that new period that we're living in of like kind of self isolation, it has a new feel. And I think, I don't know, it's so easy to just kind of lose yourself to your own madness and stuff. But
that's interesting.
I don't know in terms of what else this movie could be about. I'm trying to think of like subtext for this film, and other than the obvious like madness and like writer's block. I mean, that's the other thing I guess I also maybe took away from this movie, right? There is this understanding that I have with Jack, because I wanted to be a screenwriter, and like trying to sit down and write and nothing comes out is the most maddening experience ever. And
writer's block,
I think you can ask Eddie, he must know. Anytime I try to do something creative and stuff, and if I can't do anything, I get so angry. Don't talk to me for the rest of the evening. Eddie, true or false? Yeah, see?
Really?
Because it's frustrating. Like, writer's block is a real thing, and it's super frustrating. I think they capture that well. And, when he was screaming at Wendy saying, don't fucking come into the room when I'm writing, it's like, you know what? I relate, Wendy. Stop bothering him with your fucking sandwiches.
Even though, you know, he never, like, really wrote anything. He's, like, yelling at her to leave him alone.
Crazy.
Well,
that's the problem with writer's block, right? I think that's what sucks about writer's
block.
Don't
bother me. I'm going crazy.
I've literally, like, sat at a computer for, like, 2 hours and, like, not been able to kind of come up with anything. Or anything I come up with, I feel, like, super judgmental about, and I hate it. So I relate. And, so for me, this is what... So now this is, like, a warning on writer's block. It will make you go crazy.
It will make you, yeah. Well, so, you know, this is not my favorite Kubrick film. And I've never really been the type of person who's like, let's watch The Shining. I actually, like, don't think I've sat through it the entirety after, like, the first time I've ever seen it.
Okay.
And that's because I don't think this movie has that much good character development. I actually think this film, in terms of a story, is pretty flawed. I think it's fucking stunning. And I think that it's atmospheric and it's all the beautiful stylistic things that a Stanley Kubrick movie is. And then it makes you realize, oh, wait, what's the story about? And who am I supposed to like relate to? Kind of something that like Wes Anderson also does. And it drives me crazy. It's like, oh, my God, you're so beautiful. Oh, wait, why do I feel so empty? Like, what is your fucking movie about? And that's the one thing that I leave kind of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. And then also Dr. Sleep, because it makes me wonder what the novel had. Because Stephen King was so upset with the way that this adaptation of his book turned out that he made a miniseries in 1997. People who are just familiar with the visual ways of The Shining could see what he at least hoped it really would be. And that's the thing, like, they're kind of just a bunch of archetypes, you know? Jack Torrance was kind of an asshole from the beginning, and then he just becomes a lunatic asshole, and he doesn't have any redemption to him. And, you know... Shelley Duvall is just a victim the entire movie. And is it about The Shining or is it about Jack Torrance's descent into madness? Like, it's kind of unclear.
Yeah, I mean, The Shining itself, like, itself does play a very small part.
Very small into part. This movie.
Like, Dan's powers are kind of just like, what exactly do you see dead people? Cool. but, like, what is Tony? What is he helping you? Can you explain that to me, Danny? I don't know. And,
the power of The Shining itself is kind of left unanswered. And something that they try to answer a little bit more in Dr. Sleep. But for me, I just kind of got a little bit more confused. I don't know about you. I mean, should we just jump into it?
Let's.
Because the sequel gives a better sort of understanding of The Shining.
And because I think the sequel has an actual plot that I would agree with you, Nicole, The Shining itself is just like kind of the watching like a madman, like watching the story of a madman.
Yes. Yes, and pretty much.
Dr. Sleep is an actual plot. So let's go to it. Let's talk Dr. Sleep. Oh, wait, but before we actually do, I just want to mention one thing. This movie was nominated for a couple of awards. You want to know what it was nominated for?
The Shining or Dr. Sleep?
Shining. That was good. Dr. Shining.
What was it?
The Shining. It was nominated for Worst Actress, Shelley Duvall by the Razzies, and Worst Director,
get the fuck out of here,
Stanley Kubrick.
Really? I wonder if the film did not get good reviews when it came out.
That's a great question. Hang on. Let me see. What the critical reception for was. Initial reviews. It first opened to mixed reviews. They lauded Jack Nicholson's performance and praised the Overlook Hotel as an effective setting for horror, but wrote, the supernatural story knows frustrating little rhyme or reason. There you go. That's your complaint right there.
Yep.
even the film's most startling, horrific images seem overbearing and perhaps even irrelevant. Yeah, that's my complaint, right? Where I think it's just like, it's not real horror. It's just like cool visuals.
Oh, wow. Pauline Kael said, again and again, the movie leads us to expect something, almost promises it, and then disappoints us.
Okay, so there you go. So the general public seems to have this love for this movie because it is a visually stunning movie. I think visually this movie is it does captivate. But
yeah, in this movie, it's definitely style over substance.
I would agree with that. But nonetheless, I do still enjoy this movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's so visually stunning that I have to give it to it. But I can't say that it's Stanley Kubrick's best or actually a great, great movie. It's a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
But it's not a great movie.
I would agree with you on that. We may get some disgruntled
messages. We might get some really angry Stanley Kubrick fanboy who's ready to fight me. But it's cool.
So now we can talk Dr. Sleep.
When I was a kid, there was a place. A dark place. They closed it down and let it rot. But the things that lived there. They come back.
Dr. Sleep.
Dr. Sleep came out last October in 2019. And
Veterans Day.
Written for the screen by the director, also Mike Flanagan. You know what else he did?
House of Haunted Hill. Hush.
He did the Haunted Hill Netflix series.
Yeah, the House on The Haunting of Hill House.
The Haunting of Hill House, yes. I'm sorry. Which is something we haven't covered, but
which we wanted to.
But it's kind of such a rough one because it's so different that we just decided not to. Yeah. He also made this movie called Before I Wake, which my girlfriend really loves.
The what?
A film called Before I Wake.
Before? No, I don't think I've ever seen that one.
No? Okay.
Well, I've seen Hush.
Said it was really nice. You've seen Hush? Did you Hush, like Hush?
Hush, I remember me and Eddie saw this one when we were in Cape Cod at my boss's house. And it was just me and him in like a relatively secluded area. So it was a terrifying movie to watch.
Yeah, I would never do that. A horror movie. I have to be in the comfort of my own home. Preferably start it with daylight.
We did see that movie Before I Wake.
You did see Before I Wake?
Yeah.
Did we you
saw
like that? It?
You yeah. saw it? Or?
Remember it's about the boy when he goes to sleep, he manifests butterflies?
Oh my God. Yes, I do remember. That movie was not that good. like that movie that much.
That's Before
Eddie, how did you feel about that movie?
It was okay.
Yeah, okay. That's it.
So Dr. Sleep actually was a book written by Stephen King. You know, apparently Stephen King got asked so many times by his fans what happens to the Torrance family, in particular Danny Torrance, after the events of The Shining, to the point where he started asking himself that question. And it took him a long time, but in 2013, he wrote the book Dr. Sleep. And almost immediately, Hollywood was interested in adapting it. And they had Akiva Goldsman of the Picard series write an initial script. But it kind of got shelved and they didn't want to put money into it until It came out and made a lot of movie. And then they rushed this into production. Mike Flanagan rewrote the script and then he was signed on as a director. And boom, Dr. Sleep, the movie was born. Cast as the adult version of Danny Torrance is Ewan McGregor.
Not
Jason Bateman.
Yes.
And that's pretty much the only other character from the original The Shining, other than an actor who plays Halloran, who comes back in the form of Danny's imagination. True.
Wendy's in it. So is technically Jack Torrance.
Oh, yeah, they are flashback scenes. Well, I guess as in terms of the actual plot.
Jack Torrance is kind of a big deal for the plot-wise.
But like not as an act, like a character in the movie.
Yeah, he's a character in the movie.
Briefly at the end.
Yeah.
We're going to be jumping around. Okay, so here's the thing about Dr. Sleep. Mike Flanagan has gone on record saying that he really, really wanted to make a faithful adaptation of the book, but he recognized that he could not ignore The Shining, the movie, which is very different from the novel. And I think that that's kind of the perfect way to set up this movie, is that Dr. Sleep kind of feels like the child of two divorced parents in the middle of like a bitter like divorce battle, and they're like trying to pick a side, but because of that it's like kind of teetering the lines between both, and it's just like, pick a side. Are you a fucking version of the novel that is more faithful to The Shining as a novel, or are you to the movie? And that's where this movie kind of I don't know. That's the thing. I like this movie, but I think it kind of loses it in some points.
Oh, that's so interesting. I feel the complete opposite of you, where I actually think Mike Flanagan did a good job of kind of taking this to be a sequel, kind of still like honoring, like saying it's just like, okay, we're going to follow this continuity, and I'm still going to make it my own movie, but still without like necessarily trashing completely The Shining.
Well, so it starts off beautifully, but I think it gets so caught up in the lore and people's like obsession with The Shining that it starts to confuse me in terms of the actual plot.
Well,
then it becomes a distraction where I'm like, oh, here's this Shining reference. Here's this Shining reference. I'm like, I'm actually so caught up in this brand new story that you don't need to put all these Shining references in it.
So that's so interesting. All right. So let's actually talk a little bit about plot, because if you had to summarize this plot is a story of Danny Torrance. Now a full-fledged adult who is suffering basically the PTSD that comes from having a homicidal father and having these powers that he never wanted.
Yes.
That would be like, that's like kind of like your main character.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that now he is kind of connected to this new girl, Abra, who herself has similar powers to Danny, probably even stronger.
Yeah.
Right? And they're kind of bonded together, similar to how he was bonded to the chef. Shit.
Halloran. Yes. Halloran.
So similar to how they're bonded, they're kind of bonded as well. And she is being hunted down by these energy vampires who were my favorite thing about this movie, to be honest, right? Like, mm-hmm. The only time I'd seen energy vampires in media was in that new show.
What We Do in the Shadows?
What We Do in the Shadows, right? It's a great effect. I think energy vampires are kind of like this fresh new idea in media that it kind of is just like, oh, this is interesting and similar. Yeah. In this movie, it was a very fresh thing that I had not experienced in the movie. And I was just like, oh, this, okay. All right. Let me learn more about this culture. Because I thought they were like initially just like gypsies. Is that a problematic term?
Probably.
Okay. Romani?
Nomadic.
Nomadic.
There you go.
Nomadic.
Just call them hippies.
And they're called the True Knot.
They're called the True Knot. They are apparently decades, maybe even a century or so old.
No,
of energy vampires.
They were like way older than that. She said that they've seen like empires fall.
That's I was gonna say when the first guy died, they let that slip. So yeah, they're energy vampires, and the film kind of begins with setting up the fact that they need to trap people who have this power to shine, and they collect their steam. And that's something that people let out of their body when they die. But these energy vampires need to torture you because it makes it last longer and it tastes better or something, which is
shown to great effect. It's like when you beat your meat, right? And so that way you tenderize it a little.
Okay, sure.
Not the sexual way, guys. I'm talking about like a steak. You tenderize the meat with with a hammer. No?
Yeah.
No, okay, whatever.
I just wouldn't have used that as a comparison, but that's a very interesting way to put it.
That's the first one that comes to mind.
So that's how the movie begins with you seeing Rose the Hat, the leader of these energy vampires, lure a young girl, and immediately I was like, this is going to have violence against children, and I'm just not going to be okay. Because that's, again, for me, a personal thing that I just don't enjoy seeing at all.
Yeah, this movie has a lot of violence against children.
Which is, I thought it had a lot. This movie took the fucking cake on that. Which is just personally for me, like I said, it's not enjoyable.
Well, as most listeners probably assume, I enjoyed the scenes of violence against children. No, of course I didn't. I didn't. But what's it called? For a plot device, I was in on this ride. Like I said, I think these were villains that I had not seen before in media, and I was very, very much suddenly, very much drawn into this movie as a result.
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to learn more about the lore of this specific tribe of energy vampires, right?
Yes.
I was just oh, I want to know more. And I actually think the movie did a good job of kind of giving me enough to stay interested and not know everything.
Yes.
I didn't need a whole drawn out history. I just need enough to kind of follow the plot along.
To believe it and to be okay, I'm on board for this. But where does Danny Torrance take place? What does Danny Torrance have to do with energy vampires? Well, so the movie kind of begins with the scene in where young Danny is going through riding his little bike through the halls of the Overlook Hotel, bumps into the two girls and looks at room 237 like he can't go in there. And it's kind of like a flashback to set into motion who Danny becomes later on in life. We see him and his mother who have now in the post events of the original film, and they're recuperating and they're trying to build back their relationship. But young Danny is traumatized. Uh-huh. So he speaks to Halloran with his shining ability. And he teaches him that in order to just suppress everything that you feel, put it in a box. Put it in your mental box and trap them there because they feed off your energy. And essentially, this whole movie is about feeding off energy. Either in the ways of The Shining or the vampires. So Danny, becoming an expert at putting things in boxes, grows up to suppress his abilities even more by pretty much stepping into his father's footsteps and becoming an alcoholic.
That's just an alcoholic. Drugs, also. He was...
And drugs, yeah.
Yeah.
But, just, has ignored a lot and has a lot of emotional issues.
Yeah, when which is a bigger problem for people, drugs or alcohol? Which is the one that...
Well, alcoholism is a disease.
Isn't technically heroin addiction also a disease?
I don't know if that's classified. It should be because it's terrible.
I think it is. I think cocaine addiction might not be. I think heroin becomes an actual chemical.
Yeah, that probably. Yeah, because it fucks you up, and so does some the other ones.
When did he do drugs?
Cocaine in the.
They were doing cocaine
in
the scene, but it really seemed like it
was
alcoholism.
Just her?
No, I'm pretty sure it was him also.
I'm sure he engaged, but I think it's more so
alcoholism.
There's
no way he did not do blow when there's a woman, like, I'm sure, riding him.
Yeah.
Okay. Who, mind you, had a child also. What a disturbing scene that was.
Yeah, that was really fucked up, actually. I was like, again, with the neglect of children. But so somehow, though, he finds his way into an AA meeting. And he gets better.
After he moves to New Hampshire.
After he moves to New Hampshire, he gets better. He finds people who can help him and set him on the right path. And he gets a job working at a hospice. Mm-hmm. And him and this cat start comforting people who are... And also, the cat is based on a real cat, by the way. Did you guys know that?
Of course I know that.
Everyone yeah, that's a famous story.
Inside Edition story.
Yeah, because it's such a great story. But him and the cat are there comforting people as they transfer from this life into the next. And you actually see steam in one of these moments while he's watching someone die. He sees steam literally leave someone's mouth as they die, which I guess is a person's soul. Because
of the people, like... He had learned that a lot of people have steam. They may not just know it. And, you know, that's why the energy vampires are out hunting for these people, because I think the implication is that steam is kind of dying out. Like, there's not as much steam in the world as there was before.
That guy that he was there for when he died, that's why he was able to telepathically communicate with him.
Because he had a little bit of steam.
He had a shining.
He had a shining.
And that's why he had steam. Okay, sorry. Then I misunderstood.
I got that. I had that moment during the actual movie. When the vampires are kind of explaining, like, the fact the steam is running out. What is it? Which, again, they're building out this lore that I was kind of into. Which is like, oh, what is killing the steam? I'm assuming our quick move to, like, prescription drugs. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure that's killing out steam.
Yeah, yeah. Like, find her and make sure her parents don't send her to therapy and all
exactly.
this stuff.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But where was I? Oh, yeah. So that's why he's called Dr. Sleep. One of the patients, you know, kind of like in a Forget It, Jake, It's Chinatown moment. He's like, oh, that's what you should call yourself, Dr. Sleep.
I mean,
it was just weird.
I felt that was forced, but.
Okay. Yeah, I felt it was forced, too. It was just kind of like, I don't know.
I feel like that was Stephen King. Like, it's just like, perfect. This is Dr. Sleep. Dr. Sleep.
And then somehow he meets this girl through their minds.
She had met him 8 years prior. Like, he had started sensing her a while back.
Yeah, but they met in their minds.
Yeah, they've only been meeting through the mind.
Through their minds.
Like, through their chalkboard.
Which, and this is just something that maybe I'm just like, it was hard for me to keep on touch with. But when, like, the whole astral projecting and stuff got a little confusing to me in this movie, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, she's a super powerful being. I don't understand.
She's incredibly powerful, Abra. She's, like, ridiculously powerful. So there was actually a character who I kind of have some gripe with, because I ended up thinking that they were completely pointless, and that was Snakebite Andy. What the fuck was the purpose of Snakebite Andy?
The snakebite girl?
The blonde 15-year-old.
Oh, so she was... I'm assuming that she had herself some steam, right?
No, she did. She was a pusher.
Okay. And,
and they just recruited her, and then she was in,
like, eating
four scenes, and then she dies.
Well, I mean, it was, as far as I was concerned, that was a pretty satisfactory, like, killing of a character, because I hated her so much. She kind of turned so vile so quickly.
Yeah, well.
She really had to. Yeah. And as a result, like, I think it was, you know.
So, in the book, she was abused by her father as a young girl. She hated men. And what she would do is she would trap pedophiles.
Pedophiles, yes.
Pedophiles, yeah. And then...
And then mark them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
great introduction scene, though.
Why
I
not
love
put
that,
like,
introduction.
A P, though, instead of viper marks? I feel like a P would have been, like Scarlet Letter. No?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like an A.
P, and it's just like, they'll
P for pedophile. Yeah, true. Well, I thought that was a great character introduction. I'm like, oh my God, this character is going to do such crazy stuff. She's going to give me anxiety later on this movie. And none of that happened. And I guess I was just, like, you know, anticipating that maybe she might take over for Rose the Hat and be the one that they had to stop at the end. It felt like they built up her character for more, and
but I think
deliver.
That I think, so I actually think that might have been to the effect similar to what she was feeling herself, of the fact that when she was recruited, she thought she was gonna be immortal, right? And all of a sudden now she finds out that it's like, oh, we're fucking dying out. Like, talk about shitty circumstances, right? It's like, I'm a fucking energy vampire because you lied to me, and I can die any moment. So, yeah, there's kind of, like, that moment that you felt of kind of just, like, oh, that was for nothing. I feel like that's what she felt.
So it was really like a method experience for the audience.
Exactly. That's how I genuinely.
Well, that's really nice of you. I don't know. I just felt like her character was. I expected more. But it was okay because Rose the Hat was. I enjoyed Rose the Hat.
I would say Rose the Hat was kind of such a cool character on her own.
Yes, she was.
That like I'm okay with like the way these characters were kind of ended up being built out.
Yeah, I mean, totally, you know, the movie could have completely removed Snakebite Andy and been like 20 minutes shorter.
Fair. But the movie was a little long. I will agree.
It was a little long. So anyway, so Rose the Hat and her tribe, they're dying out. Steam is dying out. They find a boy in Idaho. They fucking torture him in a terrible scene. And then Abra gets like kind of like has this moment where she's connected to what's happening and she's present for it. And Rose the Hat can feel her. Because Rose the Hat is also has the Shining herself, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Well, so yeah. I think not only does she have the Shining, but does she absorb the people's powers, or no. Is that okay?
A lot of them of that group do have the Shining. Do have the Shining.
Yeah.
Or an ability. They have an ability.
Because when they die, they really shine, and I don't think it's just everything they
steam.
Steam.
Steam. Yeah.
Steam.
Shiny steam. So I guess they do have the shine themselves, and that's where things get a little tricky for me, is because half of the last half of the movie I think kind of takes place with astral projection, with them in each other's minds, and it was really hard for me to differentiate where they were and if anyone was in person. Was that hard for you guys, or did I
to follow along like to follow along like the who's jumping into who?
Yeah.
No, I actually didn't. I actually did not have a hard time following along, like the who's jumping into whom and stuff and what's going
okay.
on.
Okay. So I just need to clarify then that they actually drove to the Overlook Hotel in Colorado.
Wait, you talk really low. What happened?
They actually drove to the Overlook Hotel in Colorado then in person.
Yes.
That was something that
That happened in person. Yes.
Okay. Something else that I felt was like, really? They're going back to the Overlook Hotel. Wow, way to like keep The Shining really alive and present in this movie, even though it's such a standalone movie that we don't really need to go back to the Overlook Hotel.
I would agree with you. I think this movie probably would have been fine without necessarily all the Shining references, but I actually did appreciate the Shining references. Especially here's actually why I ended up liking the way they play the Overlook Hotel in this movie.
Okay.
Because the implication suddenly became that, like, the Overlook Hotel, because of, I'm assuming, where it's been built and everything, mm-hmm. it itself is kind of like its own form of an energy vampire, too.
Yes.
It feeds off of The Shining and stuff. And
yeah.
I think that was a good way to kind of bring everything back to here. I thought it was played to great effect, and I think the last 25 minutes of the movie is a little bit of fan service for people who may have liked the original one.
Yeah, I think that's what it felt like.
And I don't disagree with you, right? I think there were a lot of callbacks to like the way some things were shot, or callbacks to like, you know, flipping of gender roles, right? Where you have Rose coming up and like you have Danny swinging the axe this time, like, you know, similar to like how Shelley Duvall did it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of callback moments, you know, the maze.
Yes.
All things that like we associate so passionately with The Shining.
Yeah. I mean, I know a lot of people are going to go to the movies and just kind of want to see those things. And I know that's kind of like why it was there. But I felt just like I kind of wanted the actual story that we've been invested in for an hour and a half to just keep moving forward. And all of these moments were interrupting that.
Well, so the reason I think for me it's not that big of a deal was because the story was resolving. Like, literally, this is, like, the big showdown. And the big showdown just needed this setting. And as Danny put it, it's just, like, the reason I'm bringing it here is because maybe if it feeds off of energy, she'll be, what's it called? She'll fall victim to it because she doesn't know about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good, I think that it was a well-executed trap. And it made sense in along the parameters of the story. Because keep in mind, like, I agree with you, right? Everything up until that point, like, the movie was sort of moving forward. This is literally the very ending.
Yeah.
And all the ending just did was kind of just take us back to where it all started, quote-unquote, you know, the Shining franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was a little bit of fan service, but like I will take that little bit of fan service instead of giving me an entire movie that was all fan service. Right? It didn't feel like a remix of the movie.
It did not. No, which right? is it felt like its own movie. Which is
why I can be appreciative of it as opposed to when we saw Mary Poppins, right? Which was just a remix of the original storyline.
Yeah.
There have been other examples that come to mind, but I can't think of them right now. But you know,
no, you're right. And I mean,
as it was just the final set piece. It was the final fight, the final boss battle. I thought it was done pretty well and stuff. And
well, I know that the movie of Dr. Sleep ending differs from the novel, and that actually the Dr. Sleep ending, in terms of at least Danny, is closer to what the Shining original novel was. And that they wanted to parallel that to kind of give like a nice closure to the Jack Torrance and Danny Torrance story.
Right, like how Jack blew up the hotel. I think in the novel, yes. if I remember
that's
correctly.
What happens in the Shining novel. And yeah, he has these moments where he's able to like come in and out of his possession.
Yeah, so in the novel, right. So in the novel, the Overlook Hotel is just rubble.
Yeah.
That where it takes place. And in this one, they had to like obviously... Go back movie, to it. And yeah. They're back at the actual hotel.
Yeah. And that's when I can tell. I was like, okay, this is added. This is added stuff. Like, they're
not
going
added.
To this. This is
it's
very much
added.
For
it's
the
modified.
Movie.
It's kind of modified to fit the world. And
well, I mean,
built.
If the Overlook Hotel was destroyed in the novel of The Shining, then
right.
Yeah,
but, like, we're following. But this movie isn't following the novel. This movie's following
this
the movie.
This movie's following. Well, that's the thing, too. Because it's, like, trying to tell the story of the novel, but people are obsessed with the film and are there to see kind of like the film, and people are somewhat only familiar with the film. That's where it, for me, kind of gets hazy too, because it's like, okay, so wait, so Jack Torrance was a good guy? Like that whole Alcoholics Anonymous scene where he's like, you know, my father stood here at 5 months and all he wanted was to like get better and he never did. And then that scene where he's there at the bar talking to his father. And I'm like, but this isn't the same father from the movie. Is this the same father from the novel? Like, there were some times where I was like, well, which
Nicole,
father is it?
You are aware that this movie is not following, it's not following this novel. Yeah, this book, this movie is following the novel, right? The sequel.
It's following the novel, yeah.
But it's still a sequel to the movie.
But that's the thing, because it's trying to be faithful to two different properties that have conflicting
But
like,
all right, how about this? Did you read Dr. Sleep?
I read the fact that Mike Flanagan himself is like
isn't that kind of moo if you haven't read the source material?
No, because it feels confusing though, because he's talking about two different Jack Torrances, and I can see it. I'm like, I know this Jack Torrance from the movie, but apparently this Jack Torrance is from The Shining, which I haven't read either book, but I can tell that there's a conflict here.
Is there? No, because I genuinely thought that. So the Jack Torrance that was there, I actually thought it was just a hotel kind of just manifesting. I think it is Jack Torrance, his father, but like it's Jack Torrance, his father, that the hotel is just projecting to try to like entrap him into what's it called? To fall back into alcoholism, to start drinking so he can go himself mad. Right. The hotel. So Jack Torrance is just a ghost at this point. He's just a figment of the hotel's imagination.
Man takes a drink. The drink takes a drink. And then the drink takes a man. Ain't it so, Dad? Medicine. Medicine is what it is. Bona fide cure-all. Depression, stress. Remorse, failure, wipes it all away. The mind is a blackboard. And this is the eraser.
Right. Even though with that earlier AA scene, too, it just felt like, okay, so wait, who is he talking about? That cold-hearted son of a bitch who tried to kill him? Or is he talking about the Jack Torrance in the novel that's supposed to have been, you know, actually a better father for him?
He's talking about obviously the cold-hearted son of a bitch who tried to kill him, because that's
but that doesn't make any sense. And that's why I think that there are moments where it's talking about the old film, and then there's moments where it's referring to the novel. And Mike Flanagan himself has openly said that he's trying to reconcile both of them. He's trying to reconcile the Shining novel and the movie.
Specifically, what I'm kind of confused now by what you're confused by, because I think the movie and it's on its own, like,
as a person who's only seen the movie and like them talking about like certain characters and events that the way they happen, I'm like, but it didn't happen like that.
But
Jack Torrance wasn't this loving guy that you're supposed to like look back at, like almost passionately for your father.
Well, tell you now, we don't know that. We only see, because in The Shining, we only see the events that happen in the actual Shining. Remember, you had your own read on certain things that I myself didn't feel that way.
So you never felt like, you felt at some point Jack Torrance was a very loving and caring father.
I don't think, like I said, I wasn't sure necessarily what the hell they saw in each other and stuff. But like, I think Jack genuinely does love his kid.
Even when he's in that weird scene where he's on the bed and like he's like, come here, give me a hug. And like the blank look in his face.
I think especially that. And I think
that's a perfect moment. That's a perfect moment.
Where he just seems so disconnected.
Wait, Eddie, just get a little closer to the microphone.
That's the perfect moment where you see his most vulnerable side. Mm-hmm. When he has him sitting there and he's talking to him and he's letting him know that I wouldn't hurt you. You know, I wouldn't let anything happen to you.
Even though the look on his face says something completely
Well, that's because I think he's already breaking, right? But I think it is genuinely that love that is still there. It will break. It won't survive this movie. But like, I genuinely do think that that is still there in The Shining. And again, keep in mind, like, we're all in The Shining, we only see literally the events that mostly happen in the hotel. That's why I never necessarily said that. Is Jack Torrance necessarily a bad guy, or is he just a victim of the hotel? I think it's like a little bit of, I would say it's like maybe 60-40, right? I don't think that Jack, is necessarily a good stand-up guy. I think he's just a victim of his circumstances, who kind of hates his life, but like is just rolling with the punches. And the hotel fed off of that weakness and was able to use him to do its bidding, which is to try to, you know, absorb as many souls as possible. Maybe he had discontent for his wife, but I don't think that necessarily translated to, like, hating his son. And I know that he abused him. Like, well, we know that there was a moment of abuse, but we also do know that he gave up alcohol as a result of that, right?
Wow, you're giving the original Shining like he chose to drink a little bit more credit than it deserves.
No, just I'm just saying.
I guess we can be left to assume these things about their relationship, but based solely on what I know from the film is that it was a not good relationship.
I don't know. So I think they were just a broken family, but not necessarily a bad family. And I think that's why I wasn't necessarily confused by what was going on in the
bad
in the
is sequel. A, is I a bad
I don't even think
term.
They were
I
a bad family.
Sad.
I think when it comes to his mom, she was like loving to both of them.
Oh, but she was really, so annoying.
No, she wasn't annoying.
Oh, that's
she's just
subjective.
A very nice person who just really loved her family and wanted to work out. Even it came to the point where she accepted this abuse, or she put up with it.
Yeah,
but he was the broken one here.
I agree, he was broken,
you know, and his alcoholism and him struggling with his own life choices, or being very like going through a midlife crisis possibly. He definitely was at a point of his life where he had cracks, and that's where the hotel just bleed itself into those cracks.
Yeah,
and brought forth his darkness. And I think the movie does say more about the dark nature of man, of an individual, and the possibility of us becoming something monstrous. And that's what happens to this man. He becomes something monstrous.
Mm.
And actually, to feed off of that, technically Dr. Sleep will kind of reinforce that with the way Danny himself also breaks. Because Danny breaks.
Yeah, he does.
He does, and I think Abra is able to kind of, I think Danny breaks kind of, so that's where the ending kind of fits more like the original novel, to my understanding, where Danny is able to kind of end this hotel, which is something that they didn't do in the original movie.
Yes.
He's able to burn it down. He still has that moment of kind of, he's able to kind of break through. I think actually he breaks through, though, because of her strength, not even his own stuff.
I think so, yeah, because Abra has just, like, apparently right. incredible
well, she makes,
steam.
She makes a remark. This isn't your face.
Oh, right.
Yeah, she makes this remark.
This is your false face.
Which I think, too, I'm not remembering right now, but I think Danny in The Shining that. Also makes that remark.
He does,
And that's the moment where Jack is able to come forth, fight the darkness to give enough time for Danny to run, for Danny to save himself.
Yes. Too. Okay.
But
yes,
what I love about Abra is, well, first of all, we haven't said anything about her character or this actress, which I thought was amazing performance on her part. There was something badass about her.
Yeah, she was great.
A confidence and an assurance that really came out. When I watch movies with children that are paranormal, I've never seen one so confident about their ability. And also that she has follow through, which I'm a big fan of follow through. Like, if you're going to kick ass, make sure you kick ass really well. And that's what she does in this movie with no regret. But she says, basically, this isn't you. This is your false face. Snap out of it. Get yourself together because we got a job to do.
Ugh, how much better would it have been if she pulled a chair and just like smacked him? Just like, snap out of it.
No, it was, she was a great character, I think.
Oh, no, and yeah. I thought she was good. I agree with you on everything you just said. Yeah, I think.
Yeah.
I think it was Abra that kind of made him strong enough, because I think the hotel would usually win. It was able to beat down Rosie with no fucking problem, you know what I mean? So I think the hotel is the problem. So yeah, I think it follows the continuity of The Shining just fine. I don't think it's like kind of muddling
the movie.
The movie. I don't
feel the interference of the novel in there, or like the conflicting, like, because that's the thing. At the end of the day, he's was given a great task. He had to give it to the fans of the novel of The Shining and the movie, and that's a big task. So there will be, I think that the end just felt so much like it was trying to like give into like the fans of the movie, and like just like, here's like, you know, here's like another like pat on the back to the original movie, and here's another moment, and here's another moment, that it, after a while, it just kind of ran out of steam.
But. Ooh. So what's the bigger population, though, do you think? The fans of the movie or the fans of the book?
I don't really know. I think that people are more familiar with the movie, though, which is weird, though, because he's making an adaptation of a sequel of a novel to another novel. So it gets a little, like,
despite the fact that Hollywood, foggy. I mean, Hollywood. So here's the thing, right? So if they wanted to just make an adaptation of this novel and not associate itself with The Shining, the movie, like, it would be an impossible task, I think. Like, I think you needed to do a little bit of fan service to get the viewers. Now, here's the irony of all this, right? Of this discussion that we're having. This movie flopped hard.
Yeah.
This movie was number two its opening week, which was a holiday weekend, no less. Mm-hmm. It lost to Midway, which was a Roland Emmerich movie, if I remember correctly.
Don't even remember that. Wow.
Okay. Let me just check my facts here, but I'm pretty sure Midway by Roland Emmerich, yeah.
Wow.
Gross. I didn't know Roland Emmerich was still making movies. Midway. Guess what that movie's about?
Cars.
The Battle of Midway. Come on. It's a World War II movie.
Is it?
Yeah.
No idea.
Battle of Midway, one of the big important battles of the Pacific during World War II. All right. Anyway.
Are you reading this off of Wikipedia?
No. God, no. I heard this movie was just like not good. So that's the other irony, right? Like, this movie was it had pretty bad reviews and bad word of mouth, and it still beat out Dr. Sleep, which actually had pretty good reviews. I think it had solid like reviews and actually positive word of mouth, right? I would probably be one of, had I seen it in theaters, I probably wouldn't have been one of the people coming out saying, oh, you know what, worth checking out. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I don't know why it flopped. And but the funny thing is, though, that for that weekend of the movie theaters, like, it actually was a huge drop in numbers for that week, compared to like other years and stuff.
I think most people who are fans of the movie of The Shining are like, that movie doesn't deserve a sequel. It doesn't need a sequel. Like, I mean, you've tried to watch it with a group of your friends for movie night, and they were all like, no, we're not doing this.
That's true.
Nobody wants to watch a sequel to The Shining.
This is for a different reason. All right. He basically said, I want to be lazy. I want to kill two birds with one stone. All right, I'm going to make you guys watch this, a 2.5 hour movie, which automatically breaks the rule of no movie should be more than 2 hours.
That okay?
And they were like, you know what? We're going to bust your chops. No. You're being lazy. No. That's the only reason why.
I have a lawyer and someone who thinks he's a lawyer.
So
in my group.
Well, a lot of people, though, were just like not interested in seeing this. You know,
no.
Like, the concept of it being a sequel to The Shining wasn't very appealing to audiences.
And I think, so keep in mind, like, the movie is part of a string of other Stephen King adaptations that have been kind of failing.
Yeah.
Dark Tower comes to mind. It number two was also not a big success. It wasn't as successful as they wanted it to be.
Was Pet Sematary?
I don't even think was Pet Sematary. Let me see. Pet Sematary 2019 box office brought home $113 million. It had a what was the budget? $21 million. All right, so it was successful.
Oh, that was probably
very a cheap movie to make. Yeah. So that's those are good numbers, but you know, not. I don't know. What did we think of Pet Sematary? I forgot. We liked it.
We liked it. Yeah,
we liked it. Liked it a lot. It's one of my. One of my favorite episodes of our podcast.
But was it one of your favorite Stephen King adaptations in recent memory?
Yes.
Okay. I like it still number one.
I saw. Yeah, definitely like it, and also because it fed off of the whole Stranger Things.
It's fair. Wait, no. Are you thinking of it?
Yeah.
Oh, I was gonna say we're talking about Pet Sematary though.
Well, then you said it, and he agreed with
you. Oh, I see. We're just confusing all Stephen King novels. Yeah. No, but my point is, though, that I think Stephen King novels right now might be properties that, like, Hollywood might be rethinking.
Yeah, yeah.
I think is what's going to be happening, because, yeah, the numbers for Dr. Sleep weren't that good, which is a shame, because I actually thought it was an enjoyable film. I actually was surprised at how much I enjoyed it, mostly because it had a pretty solid plot.
Yeah, I liked it, too.
Like, you know what we were complaining about with The Shining, where there kind of is no plot. It's just kind of seen the descent into madness. This one had an actual plot.
It
had like a mystery. It was like kind of sweeping all over the country. It had pretty cool bad guys. You know, like I was actually one of my favorite scenes actually might have been when Danny astro projected into Abra, right, and like caused that car accident. That was a pretty hot scene. Again, it's because you have all these kind of like conflicting bad guys that are like kind of. Who is more powerful? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So basically, I'm just saying, it's just like, yeah, guys, check it out.
You say check it out. Do you think it was needed?
I think that's a good question. Does The Shining, I don't know if The Shining needs a sequel. So that's the question, right?
Which is why a lot of people didn't see it because people don't think it needs a sequel.
Do I think The Shining.
But people asked for it. At least for the book.
Stephen King,
because he gave them, gave them a choice. Either a Shining sequel. Or another book from the Dark Tower series. And everybody was like, I want a Shining sequel. So people wanted to know what happened to Danny.
Yeah, they did.
And and his mom.
So I think that this sequel is needed. Because I do like this idea of kind of exploring the PTSD of characters in horror movies. I think that I find that interesting, right? And I think Halloween, for example, did that to great effect, where in the reboot, I forgot what we classified it
for what
Halloween, when we did Halloween.
Oh, that was
it was like a reboot revival.
There's a word for it. It's
like a hybrid
retcon.
A retcon. Like a hybrid. Yes, you're right. Retconning. So in that retcon where we saw Laurie's character go through her own PTSD and how did it manifest? It manifested in her being a bad mother, quote unquote, bad mother in the sense that like she was more worried about like the safety of her child, like teaching her how to be like a survivalist.
Yeah.
And it kind of, you know, the government deemed her a bad mom as a result. So I kind of am enjoying these ideas of like revisiting these characters and seeing like how horror. What effect does it have on these characters, right?
Yeah.
Because it makes it makes for interesting storytelling.
Yeah, what happens after Happily Ever After?
Yeah, and I think Danny going to, you know, becoming an alcoholic is not out of the realm of impossibility. It's just like, well, you dealt with some shit, man. Like, and you hear voices. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's talk The Sixth Sense, right? Like, if they did a revival of The Sixth Sense, like, you know Haley Joel Osment's character is going to be, like, all sorts of, like, drugged out and trying to, like, silence voices.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought it was needed. I think it had, like I said, really, really cool bad guys. It was a fun watch for the most part, I would say. I was on this ride and I was enjoying it. And that's all I usually ask for in a movie.
I mean, I, for the most part, agree with you with kind of the fan service. Preferably I've toned down on my end. But I also liked how not tropey it was. I liked how it continued into the thing that The Shining kind of laid out, which is that horror movies don't need to have jump scares and don't need to have, you know, really, really scary things in order to like really captivate us and actually in its own way provide us everything we want from a horror movie. It was a nice change of pace, at least for films of this day and age, because it felt like a lot more original in a weird way.
Yeah, which reminded me, what genre would you have classified Dr. Sleep? Because I think Dr. Sleep has like an indiscernible genre.
I mean, I would classify it as the same one, kind of like a horror film and a psychological
horror
film.
I don't know. Again, I don't know if it counted as horror. I think it was, there's some horror elements, but I think it was actually honestly more of like a crime thriller, to be honest.
Crime? No.
What are you talking about? It's about missing children that they're trying to solve. It's just like, where is this missing child?
But it's not about the mystery of it.
No.
And it's not about, like, they need to pay for their crimes. It's about these people who are doing this horrific.
That's not true. It does become about paying for the crime.
Yes, it does.
You're
but
right. Supernatural horror, supernatural. I'm gonna not even say horror. I'm gonna say thriller. I don't know if I found a lot of. It wasn't scary, but then again, I guess it is subjective. I suppose. I don't know.
But more importantly, what do you think, Tony? I don't know. I don't like it. Sorry, I wanted to do work in Tony the whole episode, and I forgot.
Better late than never.
Better late than never. But yes, so please reach out to us. Let us know what you thought about Dr. Sleep. You can email at us, Remakes, Reboots, Revivals. Where else can they hit us up, Rolando?
You can hit us up on Instagram by finding us, Remakes, Reboots, Revivals. Mm-hmm. We are on Twitter, though it's always kind of slightly inactive. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
And Facebook. If you search for Remakes, Reboots, and Revivals, you'll find us there.
Yes, and we're on all of your listening platforms, and if you can give us a rating on something like Apple Podcasts, it really does help us, and we would appreciate it.
And we have our own website now, remakesreboots.com.
And you can check out this video on YouTube.
That's right. Well, if they're seeing the video, they might.
If you're listening to this and you want to see the video, watch it on YouTube.
Okay. And with that said, I guess.
Stay an original.
Midnight were the stars and you. Midnight and a rendezvous.